an experiment. I bought a postcard at a Grand Central Station kiosk, wrote on it just my name, plus 11954, and mailed it. When I returned to my home a couple days later, it was waiting for me in my mailbox. That's how small the town is where I used to live, and how easy I was to find when I lived there. Somewhere in Central America. Still the waves weep for us evermore. They are but Neptune's tears upon the shore. From a poem by my father. Alan Charles Weisbecker, Sr., 1921-2000. Big Blue. My last night at the town at which I used to live was spent camped within sight of the lighthouse that marks its eastern limit. I'd given up my house and was all packed up for the road life to come, the possessions I deemed irrelevant having been sold, chucked, or stored in a friend's basement. Although I was little more than a mile from my former home on the last left before the light, as I turned in, the sensation was that I'd already begun an adventure. There was a personal significance in my choice of campsites. It was only a few yards from where I'd spent my first night on coming to the eastern tip of Long Island some 40 years before, when I was 9 years old. My father had brought me to the end of the road place called Montauk, named for the extinct Montaukett Indian tribe, from our home in a New York City suburb, to camp out and learn something of the natural world. To this day, much of Montauk remains relatively unspoiled, but back in the late 1950s it had a frontier feel. To a 9-year-old boy with an active imagination and whose adventuring had been limited to the writings of Jack London and Robert Louis Stevenson, Montauk's towering, saw-toothed crags, desolate rock-strewn shores, and densely impenetrable woods seemed preternaturally wild and remote, an untamed territory where fearsome beasts surely lurked. The morning after our arrival was a special one, for it was to be my first open-ocean excursion with mask, fins, snorkel, and spear gun. I'd learned to dive the previous winter in a YMCA pool, but my wild water experiences had taken me no farther than an upstate lake and the shallow, murky confines of suburban Long Island Sound. Imagine a young boy, basically a city boy, squatting on his haunches by a fire on the edge of the world. As he shakes off sleep, he gazes out from on high across a seamless expanse of blue vastness, broken only by a far distant ship, forlorn and apparently inert, its crew no doubt consumed by a serpent or kraken from below. Picture how the boy's hands are shaking as the tools of the coming sea hunter unpacked, his father smiling in anticipation of the kill of blood in the water. Imagine the shivering in the boy's gut as his fear of night monsters is overwhelmingly supplanted by the utterly human fear of a very real unknown. Imagine him so desperately wanting to be back home where his mother will hold him and reassure him that he is, even now, searching in his mind for a make-believe ailment that will keep him on shore and away from that awful blue vastness. Now, picture the boy an hour or so later, standing on this same promontory, seawater wet and breathless from the climb back up the cliff, diving knife strapped to his waist and, dangling from a stringer, a small blackfish slain by his own hand. Imagine him gazing at that now familiar blue vastness and wanting to be out there again, right away. There are crossroads in one's life. Decisions made or not made, acts of will reflecting general directions one is already disposed toward, or in some cases specifically and irrevocably determining those directions. The latter being a true moment of truth, a genuine crossroads. Knowing all that has happened since, it's clear to me that my life would have turned out very differently had I not conquered my fear and entered the water that day. 40 years later, standing by my rig on the cliff watching the lofty beacon at